We'll hear arguments next in 1484, Zerker against Stanford Daily, and the related case. Collins, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. These consolidated cases come to you on writ of certiorari to the Ninth Circuit, which affirmed a summary judgment affording declaratory relief in a federal Civil Rights Act case. The case involves search warrants and attorney's fees. I appear on behalf of the district attorney and his deputy, and I shall state the case to you and attempt to argue the search issues and the fees issues insofar as they affect prosecutorial and judicial immunity. Mr. Robert Bruce Jr. here will appear on behalf of Chief Zercher and the police petitioners and will argue those fees issues. He will take 10 minutes. I should like, Mr. Chief Justice, to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, sir. On Friday, April the 9th, 1971, the medical director of Stanford University Hospital called upon the Palo Alto police to remove a group of demonstrators who had barricaded themselves in Stanford University Hospital. Now, the main action and the press and the police was on the west side of the building. There, the demonstrators had barricaded the doors, chained them shut, and papered over the glass panels. The police attempted to force the doors and were driven back by a shower of heavy missiles. Several were injured. Eventually, ropes were brought, one door was dragged partly open, the chains were cut, and the police got in. Now, they tried first, of course, unsuccessfully, to persuade these people to move peacefully, but this failed. Now, that was on the west side. On the east side, there were also doors. These two had been barricaded shut and papered over, preventing police identification. When the police broke in the west side, suddenly the doors on the east side were opened and all the demonstrators erupted out. Now, on the east side, there was a squad of 8 men. 4 were facing to the rear, where there were sympathizers in the hall, and 4 were facing the glass doors. They attempted to hold a baton line and were successful for 4 or 5 seconds, but were clubbed to the ground. All 9 were injured, 3 severely. They couldn't identify their attackers. That was on Friday. Now, the following Sunday, a special edition of the Stanford Daily, the student newspaper, was published. That showed clearly that a photographer, or one of them, of that newspaper had been in a position where he could have seen and photographed the East Side incident, and that's what we're concerned about. The police went to the district attorney, District Attorney Brown, asking for a search warrant. Brown had had previous experience with this newspaper. In the 1969 riots, he had subpoenaed the editor and one of the staff. The subpoenas had been unsuccessful. The editor testified to the effect that a few of the photographs were available, the others had been misplaced or stolen, the defense had had full access to the photographs, and he'd done the best he could. Another staffer had the temerity to testify that the photographs were dangerous to have around, and some had been sent to Tokyo for safekeeping. Now, this was the district attorney's experience at that time. He decided, with the officer, to apply for a search warrant. The search warrant pursuant to California law, which specifically authorizes the seizure of evidence from any person or place. Provided, of course, there is probable cause and the rest. Judge Phelps of the Palo Alto Municipal Court issued the warrant. He authorized a search for film negatives and photographs. The warrant was executed at 5:30 on Monday afternoon. The officers asked for, but didn't get, cooperation in producing the photographs. After waiting a few minutes, they searched the photo lab and the main office, which was in some considerable disarray. They searched desktops, unlocked drawers, filing tops, and I add, no materials were read. As far as possible, they returned everything to the place where it was found. During the search, the officers were subjected to harassing comments, and they were photographed many times. No claim of confidentiality was made by any member of the staff at any time to any person. The search lasted 15 minutes. Nothing was seized. 1 month later, in May 1971, the Stanford Daily filed suit in federal district court seeking injunctive and declaratory relief. Affidavits were filed, depositions were noted. But before the depositions of the Stanford Daily's witnesses could be taken, their motion for summary judgment was granted and declaratory relief was afforded. This was in 1972. The district court laid down two new rules. One, in all third-party searches, that is to say, searches of persons who are not suspected of crime, in addition to the historical requirements of particularity, specificity, and probable cause, the affidavit must also contain probable cause to believe that the materials will be destroyed or removed, or that otherwise a subpoena was impractical. That's one. There was a special rule where First Amendment values are involved. This time, said the court, there must be a clear showing that, first, the materials are important, and secondly, that a restraining order would be futile. In 1973, attorney's fees were awarded by separate opinion on a private attorney's general theory. In 1974, these fees were set at $47,500. In 1977, the Ninth Circuit adopted the search opinion. But they used the 1976 Civil Rights Fees Awards Act, Attorney's Fees Awards Act, to authorize the grant of fees, and then confirmed the district court's calculation of $47,500. Rehearing and suggestions for hearing in bank were denied, and these petitions come before you. Those are the facts of the case and the statement of. Your Honours, it is our essential position that the District Court, and indeed now Council, didn't realise the extent of the rule they fashioned.
If, Mr. Collins,
yes.
If a subpoena, this is taken, it must be sought first, or these other preliminaries, and we decide against you, that would be the end of the case, wouldn't it? Because there wasn't any subpoena ducis tecum sought, and there wasn't any allegation of the kind that the district court prescribed.
It is certainly true, Your Honour, that in the affidavit presented to Judge Phelps, there was no sworn statement of the impracticality which in fact attended to this case.
Then would we have to go on to decide whether the public statement of the Stanford Daily made previously that they would not aid any prosecution or preserve any evidence or submit any evidence that would help the so-called political prosecution, we'd have to then move on to that question.
Yes, sir. May I remind this court that it reads as follows. Negatives which can be used to convict protesters will be destroyed. The Daily feels no obligation to help in the prosecution of students for crimes related to political activity. That was before. Now, in all fairness to the Daily, I must add that afterwards, that policy was somewhat amended. Now it apparently is the standing policy is to destroy all potentially incriminating unpublished photographic material. I might add that even on this, the board was split. And as to these particular events involving the injuries and the damage caused, the board split 50-50. 50% thought it warranted and 50% unwarranted.
Mr. Yes, Collins, sir. If they destroy him immediately, then you can't. What are you going to do then?
Your Honor, it is our hope that the Stanford Daily will not set a precedent for the remainder of the media. If they do destroy it immediately, we obviously cannot get it. You're quite right. But if we were to take the disarray of the offices as indicative of the efficiency...
I don't think it has anything to do with this case.
Very well, Your Honor.
I just think that the deuces tecum should do it without a search warrant. Should they? That would be the normal way.
Your Honor, it is true.
And then you can try. Then there would be a motion to quash, and you could have it out. Everybody would have his day in court.
In any event, Your Honor, they're going to have the day in court.
They don't have the day in court if you get an ex parte search warrant and come in there and search the place.
May I distinguish between two situations, Your Honor?
Well, this out.
In the one, it is undoubtedly true. If Your Honor's point is this. If Your Honour's point is there isn't a prior full adversary hearing to the taking of those photographs, then of course Your Honour is correct. But may I add this? It is undoubtedly true there will be an adversary hearing on the return. The question facing
you... Then you don't need a warrant, do you?
Your Honour, there are... In this case, considerations that would indicate a warrant should be used. First, as the affidavits show, there are staffers who have a floating relationship, I think is a fair characterization, with the paper. Now, as to them, whether they are bound by this or not, we don't know. There are the stringers and so on. Secondly, what I'm suggesting is this, that I may say, I will do X, but my efficiency in doing so is a matter that may or may not occur. It may or may not.
I don't know of any injunction or anything else that can control all of mankind's actions.
I thoroughly agree with you, Your Honor. In fact, I would say this, that any attempt by any court in advance to exercise that kind of restraint over the press should be abhorred. We should not do it. Of course not.
If you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal and allow your colleague 10 minutes, is it?
Yes, sir.
This would be the time to think about that.
Your Honor, of course.
Mr. Booth.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I represent Chief Zuercher and the four other police petitioners in this matter. Our contention is twofold. First, that no claim has been stated or proven against these officers under Section 1983. And secondly, that whether or not such a claim has been stated or proven, the judicial and prosecutorial immunity should extend to the court's agents in carrying out lawful court orders. At the very least, the special circumstances here make it manifestly unjust and unfair to award attorney's fees against these officers. First of all, even though the respondents in this case sought an injunction and were granted declaratory relief, there still is a necessity to prove elements of tort in order to hold them liable. Any duty which these petitioners owed to the respondents has been fully met. Chief Zuercher did not order, did not supervise, and was not even aware of the acts complained of in this suit. Neither was District Attorney Bergda.
Well, would you concede that they're entitled to costs, that the prevailing plaintiffs are entitled to costs in an injunctive action such as this, where you say one of your clients was not even aware of it?
Not as against Chief Zuercher, Justice Rehnquist. He's not a proper party to this case. He's not at all.
Supposing someone is found to be the proper subject of an injunction because of his participation in an unconstitutional activity or his failure to properly supervise employees, something of that sort, so that an injunction issues, although he really didn't have any knowledge of the acts for which he was which form the basis of the injunction. If an injunction issues against him, is the plaintiff entitled to costs?
I think under those circumstances, yes, Justice Rehnquist, but I don't believe under Section 1983 that there is any such theory of respondeat superior.
Well, so then your argument about the impropriety of awarding attorney's fees is based on your contention that the plaintiff shouldn't have prevailed on the merits against your clients.
No, it's based on a lack of a cause of action against my clients and also on what I believe should be an extension under the circumstances here of the judicial and prosecutorial immunity, because these officers were acting as agents of the court, carrying out the command of the court.
But judicial or prosecutorial immunity is an affirmative defense which might not disentitle the plaintiffs to an injunction or declaratory judgment, even though it might disentitle them to damages. And if they were under those circumstances entitled to declaratory judgment, would they also be entitled to costs or not? Assuming that that they did state a claim under 1983 and should have prevailed on their declaratory judgment action, but should not have gotten damages because of the immunity defense.
It's my recollection that they would be entitled to costs, Justice Rehnquist. However, we're talking about a great difference in degree here. The costs in a suit of the type you described are substantially less, not the type of burden, nor do they carry with it the stigma that an award of attorney's fees against these clients.
Well, that's the problem we had after Edelman against Jordan, isn't it? With the old Fairmount Creamery's case in this case, the court that said you could award costs against a state, you can't award damages against a state, and the question is, are attorney's fees more like costs or are they more like damages?
I think when they reach this type of level and the circumstances under which they arise, I believe that they're more like damages. I would further point out that one of the additional police officers shouldn't be held liable here either. He furnished an affidavit which was the truth. No one has contested that. And again, later on, he participated in the search, yet his acts violated no duty to these respondents.
All of these points litigated the responsibility of each person you're talking about.
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
And they were held to be liable.
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
Well, what are you arguing about now?
I'm arguing that they were improperly held. Well, they were held.
You want us to reverse that holding? We have to go all the way back to that holding, don't we?
I believe that's the case, and I think you can do that by finding that there was no cause of action stated under Section 1983.
But I don't say I can separate the attorney's fees and the finding. I think you have to get rid of both of them. That's all I was saying.
Well, I think, Mr.
Justice... Can I separate them?
Yes, I believe you can, Mr. Justice Marshall.
What authority do I have?
I think that there is a... Regardless of whether a cause of action was stated, I think that the special circumstances of this case would make it unfair to penalize these petitioners, even if they're liable for the search here, with attorney's fees.
And what statute is unfair statute? I mean,
It arises out of interpretation of statute, the 1976 Civil Rights Act amendments.
You want me to use the Chancellor's foot on this?
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't.
You want me to use the Chancellor's foot?
Yes, sir.
On this?
Well, in a sense.
Can you give me more than that?
Well, I don't believe that under the circumstances here, where attorney's fees were awarded in 1971, 5 years before the Act was amended, and the circumstances of this case with summary judgment and never an opportunity to present defenses like good faith and probable cause, that it would be unjust to apply attorney's fees regardless of the outcome of the remainder of the case. We would point out that the court acts only through its agents, in this case its police officers, and that under the circumstances they should be put in the same category here as court clerks, bailiffs, and other agents of the court. They didn't do anything improper. They got an order of the court. They served in a proper and appropriate fashion. We don't have the kind of facts that lead to the aggravated situations in which all of us would be offended. These officers acted in a proper fashion as agents of the court. In fact, Judge Peckham, in dismissing the municipal court judge from this case, found, quote, nothing but good faith in discharging his judicial responsibilities in the judge. And I would suggest to the court that that type of finding should be extended in this case to these police officers. They acted in good faith also in carrying out the command of the court.
Quite apart from any immunity, wouldn't they then have a Wood against Strickland kind of defense?
In part, yes, Your Honor.
Which is, so far as the court has so far decided, is available to any defendant sued under 1983.
But do you take the position that the summary judgment prevented that?
Well, I think that's part of it. But I think also it was a misinterpretation of the applicability of 1983 and also completely ignoring the immunities which should be applied in this case. We have cases like Pearson versus Ray and Rhodes versus Houston, a federal supplement case, Imler versus Pacman, which I think should be applied to the situation here. We've cited all those.
Does this record show how the court arrived at this fee of $47,500? Hours of service? Anything of that kind?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And it also,
how many days were they in court in connection with this injunction?
I don't recall directly, but it was based on an hourly rate. There's also a premium involved. I'm reminded there's a total of about 3 days in court, part days.
3 days in court?
Yeah, part days, Your Honor. And there's also a premium attached, as I recall.
Premium, do you mean a punitive? I'm not sure.
Judge recognized that perhaps there was value of services in excess of the amount attributable to hourly rate, although, as I recall, the attorneys for the respondents sought even more. Sort of a contingent nature type fee, in other words. I think I've made the points I wish to make. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. This case is in a somewhat curious posture. When we received petitioner's opening briefs, it struck us that their quarrel on the merits of this case was with the district court's opinion, and not so much with us. We had gone to court to obtain protection against further searches of a newspaper in situations where a subpoena would suffice. Petitioners, in their brief, barely touch upon this aspect of the case with its First Amendment overtones and aim their cannons at the district court's opinion, which they perceive to create a rather broad per se rule barring third-party searches in all cases of all sorts of people. We dealt with those problems and the practical law enforcement kinds of problems which they perceive to arise from that opinion in our reply brief, in which we suggested that the power of the police to search non-press third parties is at least subject to the rule of overall reasonableness, and that five factors, which we summarized on page 41 of our brief, made this search, in this case, unreasonable on these facts as demonstrated to the magistrate.
What should a police officer do in the Ninth Circuit after affirmance of the district court's opinion?
Well, I concede that the district court's opinion, which this court now has before it, stated a broader rule than we advocate as governing this case.
My question is, what should a police officer do in light of what's happened in the Ninth Circuit?
Well, he must present, in light of what's happened
in any third-party search, he must conform with the district court's opinion, which is affirmed by the Ninth Circuit?
Well, he must at this time, Your Honor, yes.
How are we to determine, or more appropriately, how is a police officer to determine when it's a third-party search and when it's a criminal suspect search? Neither party, as I recall, cites the Hoffa against the United States in its brief, but there is language in Hoffa that says the police are not required to guess at their peril the precise moment at which they have probable cause to arrest a suspect, risking a violation of the Fourth Amendment if they guess wrong.
I think the question you asked me, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, goes to the difference between the formulation of the district court, which I concede is somewhat broader than ours, and our position as set forth in part two of our brief. What we say is that the subpoena, what the government in the Solicitor General's brief calls the subpoena first rule, what we say is that applies where the evidence submitted by the police to the magistrate affirmatively shows that the person is a non-suspect. Let me just give a couple of examples that I think will bring this into focus. Beyond this case, plainly the evidence in this case showed that. The evidence submitted to the magistrate in this case showed that the Stanford Daily had this evidence by virtue of the fact that it was a neutral party gathering news.
Well, those are easy cases. Supposing the affidavit shows that there's reason to believe that there is secreted on the premises of the Stanford Daily 500 pounds of marijuana.
I think that's an easy case as well, and it goes in the other direction, because the possession of marijuana itself is a crime. No one could be a non-suspect, I think, in possession of a quantity of marijuana.
Even though there's nothing in the affidavit that suggests there's any knowledge on the part of any Daily employee.
I think so, and I think that, and I think further that sufficient evidence for a conviction, but it certainly raises the inference that someone in possession and control of those premises has knowledge that a crime is being committed there. I think really that what you indicated was the easy case is the typical case. The typical case in which evidence is sought from third parties is a case such as this, where evidence is in the hands of somebody. It might be a bank, it might be a lawyer's office, it might be an employer.
Let me give you an easy one. An unnamed co-conspirator. Now, the policeman's got to figure that one out?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
What would he do?
What
would he do with one?
I think he would proceed with a search warrant
application. He'd get a real good lawyer and pay him.
He'd get a warrant application.
No, he's given the warrant against an unnamed conspirator. Now, is that a third party or not? Is he supposed to determine that?
I don't think he is supposed to determine that.
Why not?
We don't contend that he is.
Why not?
We contend only that where it affirmatively appears from the material known to the magistrate that the third party is, in fact, not involved in crime.
I'm not talking about the magistrate. I'm talking about the policeman who's handed the piece of paper.
We don't ask police officers to to disobey warrants. I take it that it's their obligation to enforce warrants. That is why no damages were sought in this case.
That's why you want counsel fees against the policeman.
Your Honor, we want counsel fees against the policeman to be paid out of public funds pursuant to an indemnity statute. In a case in which the transaction cost of litigating, not anything relating to the primary conduct, the cost of litigating this matter and having this matter determined has to be borne by someone, and Congress has said where it belongs.
I thought you were defending the Ninth Circuit and the District Court's judgments only insofar as they applied to a press, where the third party is the press.
I did want to start there because I think that's all this case.
Well, do you defend the rest of the do you say any third? You just were arguing that you were defending something more, the need for something more than probable cause when any third party is involved.
We have said two things in this court, and if I may just summarize them, and then I'll state them more broadly. We say, with respect to the press, the police must proceed by subpoena absent a reason to believe that there is an impractical situation, such as the risk of destruction. And secondly, we say, with respect to non-press searches, that there are cases in which a search will be unreasonable. And that depends on an analysis of all of the facts, and we have indicated five factors in our brief which made this one unreasonable, even without regard to the special First Amendment considerations. None of those factors would apply, I take it, where the police are simply in doubt about who the third party is, or perhaps have some suspicions that don't rise to probable cause. Our position, our submission on that matter, would permit a third-party search in that situation. Now, if I may return to the situation involving newspapers.
This isn't the Ninth Circuit rule, I think.
Our second point is a narrower statement of the case than the Ninth Circuit announced. And I make no apology for that. I think that some reflection on the matter has suggested that is all that is really presented on this record. One can conjure hypotheticals on other facts that involve problems that I don't think we're prepared to discuss intelligently on a hypothetical basis. I think the District Court and the Court of Appeals were right ultimately, but I don't think I have to convince you of that for this judgment to be sustained. This case involved the newspaper. And the interesting thing about the briefs in this case is that the parties almost pass in the night on that issue. We spend all of our time discussing the facts of this case and the legal consequences that flow therefrom with the First Amendment bite that is required in cases where First Amendment interests hang in the balance. The Solicitor General on Friday filed a brief, on Saturday filed a brief to which we filed a response yesterday, in which the government concedes that there are no law enforcement interests that are impaired by a rule requiring the press to the police to proceed by subpoena when seeking material from the press. So we can put that issue aside. No substantial law enforcement issues are presented in any of the briefs in this case as to that part of the case, and that's what this case is about. Now, I'd like to stress that we do not question the issue that was raised in Brandsburg concerning the duty of the press to produce evidence when it is sought by law enforcement. No issue of privilege is presented in this case. The question is not whether evidence may be obtained from a newspaper, but how that evidence is to be obtained. It is a question not of substance, but of procedure. That distinction, to my mind, answers the objection in the arguments of petitioners that we seek some special privilege from the press. We do not. Those cases, such as Pell and Saxby, on which petitioners rely for the proposition that the court has declined to give special privileges to the press, involve claims of substantive rights or claims of substantive exemptions from duties that other citizens have. All this case involves is a question of process. By what process shall evidence be obtained from the press when it is sought?
Let me see if I have it clear. Do you think the process should be any different for the San Francisco Chronicle or the First National Bank of San Francisco?
Well, as I indicated, we would regard, for the reasons set forth in part two of our brief, a search of the First National Bank as unreasonable if the factors set forth in our brief were present. That is, if there were no reason to believe that the First National Bank were involved in any law.
Well, I'm trying to get at, is there any difference between a newspaper and anyone else on earth in this respect?
There is one difference. It is engaged in a First Amendment activity, and this Court has said...
Doesn't everyone have First Amendment activity rights?
Everyone has First Amendment rights, but not everyone is engaging in them as their business activity. A bank has some First Amendment rights, to be sure, but the business of banking is not a First Amendment activity, and no First Amendment interests of a bank are impaired.
Well, your theory is that if you're using the First Amendment right more often, more frequently, then you have some greater right than a person who uses it less frequently?
No, our theory is that if the entry into your premises will impair the exercise of your First Amendment rights, and there is another way to go about the same objective and to accomplish the same interests of government, the other way, the less burdensome means, ought to be pursued.
I still don't know whether you think a bank or the San Francisco Chronicle has a different kind of a First Amendment right.
My bottom line is that they both have the same right to be free of entry in this kind of a situation. But the analysis has to be different because the First Amendment requires a stricter scrutiny of the process than it would be applicable to an ordinary business, which a bank is. So my answer is that there are different analyses that are applicable.
What if an individual had simply gone out and taken pictures that the Stanford Daily took? And an effort was made to get a warrant to get his negatives because it was thought that he would probably burn them too. Would he be subject to the same protections that you say the Stanford Daily is by virtue of the freedom of the press?
I think it would depend on knowing some more facts than that. Certainly the kinds of First Amendment injuries are less in that situation because in that situation the individual is unlikely to have around other materials.
What if you were a scholar working on a criticism of the present administration?
Well, I think if all of those facts were before the magistrate, I think the answer would have to be yes. That it would be. I think it's important to understand the kinds of injuries that this sort of a search.
And if he were a clergyman wanting the pictures for the preparation of a sermon the next Sunday, in connection with First Amendment rights.
Well, I would have great difficulty with that search for the reasons set forth in our Fourth Amendment reasonableness analysis, and I think it would be unreasonable to do it if that were all the facts that there
Isn't
were.
Isn't a clergyman engaged in the First Amendment business at least every Sunday?
Surely he is. I think that the difference may be in the other kinds of First Amendment injuries that we're talking about. If I could just turn to what sorts of injuries we identify here, I think perhaps I could make the point more clearly. When the police enter into a newsroom in execution of a search warrant, several things happen. One, they cut off, as Mr. Justice Marshall indicated earlier, they cut off absolutely the right to address a court on the question of whether the police have a right to get those particular documents that they're seeking, whether the arguments against production would arise from whatever rights are provided by Brandsburg or under a state shield law. The right to be heard on that is cut off. Secondly, the files and records of the newspaper and whatever confidences, whatever unpublished stories, whatever drafts of editorials may be in the premises, all of these are laid bare to inspection of the police. And that does distinguish this kind of search from some of the hypotheticals that we've been discussing in the last few minutes. That kind of injury, that kind of exposure, and a needless one at that, causes a special injury in the context of a newspaper search. Thirdly, the entire newsroom is disrupted. The precise amount of time that this search took is somewhat in dispute, but it took at least 15 minutes and may have taken as long as 45.
But that's no different than a bank's operations being disrupted, is it? I mean, the First Amendment doesn't guarantee newspaper operations fiscally in the sense that they will be subject to less burden of law enforcement in that sense, so long as there's no censorship connotation.
I take it that the bank would be disrupted, and I dare say that the business of banking would be as devastated as can be if the police were executing search warrants on a regular basis in the bank. I have no doubt that that's true, and I think that under most circumstances, execution of a search warrant in a bank for this kind of purpose would be unconstitutional as an unreasonable search under the Fourth Amendment.
If you hold up the international wires in any big bank in the country for 15 minutes...
Chaos.
Chaos plus.
I think that's right.
Now,
let's go back to Justice Blackmun's clergyman a moment in relation to your last point. If the subpoena or the search took place in the parsonage, the files of the minister, including confidential memoranda about the emotional and marital troubles of his parishioners and a great many confidential things might be equally there. Would that not be true?
I think it is true, and I think that such a search would have to be...
The clergyman is entitled to no less protection than the San Francisco Chronicle or whatever.
I fear that I may have created the impression that I think it would be proper to search the clergyman. I only mean to say that in the case where someone is engaged in a First Amendment activity, and I think the clergyman is, where First Amendment interests are at stake and are impaired by a search, the case for unreasonableness is stronger. But certainly there are other situations. Take the search of the psychiatric clinic at Stanford, which occurred in this case, and it was performed by some of the same petitioners, and it's in the record. They searched the Stanford psychiatric clinic files because they had subpoenaed the medical records of a patient and were impatient to get them. There was some concern that the doctor was going to make a motion to quash, and before the subpoena became due and before a motion to quash could be brought on for hearing, they marched in armed with a search warrant and searched
them. Is that search before us now?
That is in the record, and it got into the record because we moved for an injunction on the basis of the fact that the petitioners had done it again, and the facts of that are in the record. And it's an example of the kind of danger that exists here. They marched right through, and they looked at the files of other patients. They didn't. I don't think there's any evidence that they read them, but they had access to them, and the other patients have no assurance now of confidentiality about their own files. Certainly the fact that the other patients' names are there, the fact that they were being treated at the psychiatric clinic, is now
Mr.
exposed.
Mr. Lehman,
to
can
the
I
court.
Ask you a question or two about that? The district court's opinion was on October 5, 1972. Is that the declaratory judgment that's appealed, or what is the judgment that's being appealed?
There are three opinions of the district court. The one you identify is the only one on the merits.
Did he ever enter a declaratory judgment, or is the opinion the declaratory judgment?
No, there is a judgment. For some reason, when the petitioners caused the brief to be prepared, it was not included. I'm sorry, the appendix to be prepared. It was not printed, but it is in the clerk's transcript. There was a judgment entered in about 1974.
Is that in the record somewhere?
Yes, it is. And perhaps before I will advise.
The only thing I found is the judgment of September. I don't know, sometime in September of 73, in which they deny your motion for an injunction.
Yes, there is a
sounds
judgment.
Sounds like you might have lost, and I wonder if they applied for fees.
On page 73 of your petition, there's a judgment filed July 23rd, 1974, that looks like it might be what you're referring to.
That's the petitioner's petition, I think. That must be the judgment. Yeah, it is, I think, an exhibit to one of the petitions, and it was in 1974.
Before you go on, may I ask you, who made the motion for summary judgment? I don't recall.
We did, Your Honor.
Was that motion opposed?
Yes, it was. Extensive briefs prepared and argument. I do want to respond very briefly to the suggestion that there is anything in this record that would support an inference that the Stanford Daily would have destroyed evidence following receipt of a subpoena. That is an unfortunate slur. It has no support in the record. The first thing that ought to be said about it is that there was absolutely nothing before the magistrate, absolutely nothing at all, to support such a contention in the way of competent evidence. As a matter of fact, the two editorials, about which I'll have more to say in just a moment, were not before the magistrate. There was no evidence to show that they were. The evidence that is in the record consists of the uncontradicted sworn statements of some of respondents who said that the policy of the Daily was not to destroy any evidence that was covered by a subpoena. That has never been refuted. There is the Brown affidavit to which counsel refers, which contains some hearsay statements that are conclusory, lack a proper foundation, which the district court properly refused to consider. But they were never even before the magistrate. That really leaves.
Who had the burden of proof on this question, if it was a summary judgment?
Well, I think that the answer to that question, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, is that it would have had to have been shown to the magistrate, and that all of this really is not properly considered at this stage of the proceeding.
So the district court shouldn't have and entertained or looked at any of these affidavits at all?
Well, it did say that they were irrelevant. The district court, of course, can't control what parties submit in the way of affidavits. My answer is twofold. One, it is irrelevant, and two, to the extent you wish to consider it, because it informs the atmosphere of this case, the record is uncontradicted that the Daily was law-abiding and would not.
Well, but if the Daily had the burden of proof on a motion for summary judgment, the defending parties in a lawsuit are not bound by the affidavits of interested parties.
Well, they had an opportunity to submit affidavits of their own, but there was something else. There were the editorials, and I think that they, far from proving the point that petitioners would make of them, prove exactly the opposite. And I think Justice Marshall's question highlighted it. The editorials, of which counsel read you an excerpt, which very much distorts their meaning, if read in full, and they are in the record, and I invite the court to read them. They're not long, but I invite the court to read them. They're pages 117 to 120 of the record. Are a careful statement with which the court may or may not personally agree, but it is a measured and reasoned statement written prior to Brandsburg at a time when questions of journalist privilege were very much uncertain, and actually the law of the Ninth Circuit was the other way from Brandsburg. And the editorials said, in an effort to discourage police subpoenas, we are not going to retain photographs once they've been used. My wife has suggested to me that this is exactly like the sticker which were put in cabs and buses on a routine basis saying the driver only carries $5 in change. There's not much point in holding me up. And that's what these editorials, both before and after the search, said, and that's all they said. There is absolutely no evidence in this
Mr.
record.
Paul,
and it is not.
On the question of evidence, what evidence was there that linked the chief to this?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Wasn't the chief one of the defendants, the chief of police?
Yes.
Well, what evidence was before the court that linked him to this?
The chief was a defendant because he is in charge of the police department, and we alleged that he had ratified the search and was prepared to do it again if the circumstances arose. That was never disputed. The way this issue came up, Mr. Justice Marshall, is that after summary judgment.
I mean, he is now stuck with $47,000.
There is an indemnity statute. He is not stuck personally. This award is rendered against him in his official capacity, which under California law will be payable out of public funds.
Well, why don't you make California a party?
I don't think we can do that. They were not proper parties, of course. But that is what
they're proper to pay the bill.
Well, they will pay. Actually, it's the county and the city.
Pay it too.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
May I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
About the policy of the Stanford Daily. The complaint alleges that the staff would consider itself free in the absence of service of a subpoena or other proper judicial process to destroy any materials in its possession. In light of the answer you gave Mr. Justice Rehnquist earlier, I take it you would not destroy I think the question included heroin. You wouldn't destroy. Well, I'll ask you this. Would you destroy evidence of a crime as distinguished from heroin, which the possession of which itself may be a crime? This statement contains no limitation. It says you would destroy any evidence.
And the statement has to be understood in the context in which it was addressed. The reference was to materials gathered in the course of preparing a newspaper.
Well, may I ask you this question?
Of course they would not destroy evidence of that nature.
Let's assume you had a picture of the commission of a crime. For example, in banks, they take pictures regularly of not only of robbery, but of murder committed in a bank, and there have been pictures taken of the actual pulling of the trigger, or the pointing of the gun, pulling the trigger, the very famous one related to the assassination of President Kennedy. What would the policy of the Stanford Daily be with respect to that? Would it feel free to destroy it at any time before a subpoena had been served?
The literally read, the policy of the Daily requires me to give an affirmative answer. I find it hard to believe that in an example such as that the policy would have been carried out. It was not addressed to a picture of that kind or in that context.
Well, I'm sure you're right. I was just getting to the scope of your theory.
What's the distinction between the picture Justice Powell described and the pictures they were thought to have?
Well, it's a distinction.
Just police officers instead of the president. That's the
only difference. Well, it's a somewhat more serious crime, but the proposition to which this, or the concern to which this editorial statement was addressed, was the concern that their files would be routinely taken advantage of by many people, including but not limited to the police. Others have been known to other private litigants have also subpoenaed the press. It was an attempt to head that off. I think the relevant point of this editorial for the purposes of this case, of course, is not whether it's a wise editorial policy, which I understand many papers have, but that's not the point. The point is that it was not an announcement that they would destroy evidence in the face of a subpoena. It was quite the opposite. It was an announcement that you shouldn't subpoena us because we don't intend to keep these materials long enough for a subpoena to be useful. So don't subpoena us.
Suppose the chief of police, bearing in mind that we're talking about not 1978, but 1972, 1971, having had that editorial come to his attention, issued an order to his staff or the prosecutor, with respect to these people who wrote that editorial, don't wait for a subpoena to sustain them. Get a search warrant.
Well, I don't understand.
Would you think that that editorial would lead a reasonable man to believe that maybe a search warrant was the summary procedure was essential to get the evidence?
Well, I understand that both subpoenas and search warrants are summary procedures in the sense that both can be obtained very quickly, both are obtained ex parte, and both take effect the moment that they're served. So I don't think there's any time advantage as to a subpoena.
Well, there's quite a difference between the time.
That is the relevant difference, and that's why one hurts like the devil. And the other is one that the press can
live with. Well, the subpoena deuces tecum does not require the recipient to turn the material over to the police officer who serves it. Does
no, it requires them to bring it in
some time, a week or 2 weeks.
It may be a day,
or
Mr.
A day,
Chief Justice.
But sometime
but
later.
But the policy of the Daily was to honor a subpoena. And
where
if
do
one
we find
was,
that out?
I beg your pardon.
Where do we find that out?
It's in the record.
Yes. In relation to that editorial?
Yes. I'm sorry, not in the editorial. Mm-hmm. I admit that the editorial does not say that. But the only evidence on the subject in the record was in the form of affidavits submitted after the search. Of course, the editorial wasn't before the magistrate either. I think that's the point. This magistrate issued this search warrant without any reason, and I think counsel has conceded this, without any reason to be concerned that the Daily might destroy evidence. It had nothing to do with what was before the magistrate. All the magistrate was told was, here's some evidence, and we want to go get it, and there's probable cause to believe it's there and will be useful.
And until Judge Peckham wrote his opinion, that was a perfectly good grounds for issuing a warrant.
Yes, I don't say that the magistrate was in bad faith or anything
Judge
of that
Peckham
nature.
Said but he was in good faith, did he?
He did. He said he was in good faith, and we've never contended otherwise. But the point is that on this record, that's all that was before the magistrate. And I think that's all that there could ever have been before the magistrate in almost any newspaper search case that one can imagine. If there ever is a case in which there's reason to believe that the newspaper would destroy the evidence, the rule of the courts below would permit a search warrant to issue, and we have no quarrel with that. I want to stress that although the conceptual issues that have been discussed this afternoon are fascinating. At the core of this case are law enforcement problems that don't exist. They don't exist. There are problems. I concede that there are problems.
There are real problems that exist in the procedure you suggest. Someone subjected to a subpoena ducis tecum has usually several days to respond. He can argue whether he had custody of the stuff that he was subpoenaed. if the court rules that he has to produce it, he can get a writ of mandamus to the Court of Appeals. You can delay by as much as a year or 2 years if you go by the subpoena route as compared to the search warrant process.
I think there are two answers to that. At least in California, subpoenas can be made returnable on extraordinarily short notice, the next day if that's appropriate. Secondly, if there is a motion of some kind to quash the subpoena, there really are only two possibilities, it seems to me. One is that the motion is not well taken, and surely courts are able to deal with that situation by summarily denying them if there is a situation of urgency. If the motion is well taken and there's something to be adjudicated, that's a very poor excuse for getting a search warrant and overriding the opportunity to have that heard in an orderly way.
Take a look at how long it took the Dionisio cases to proceed from the district court in Illinois through the Seventh Circuit through this court, and that really was all an argument about whether a particular thing was subject to a subpoena or not.
I grant that, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, but I would respectfully say that if there's that kind of a case, which ultimately this court found appropriate to review, it would be inappropriate to render that moot by allowing a search warrant. But I may say this, that if there is a case in which the procedural hurdles are too great and the need for speed is genuine, then I take it that a search warrant will be indicated, because in that situation a subpoena will be shown to have been impractical. I see that my time is up, Mr. Chief Justice. Thank you.
Mr. Collins, you have about 6 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I should refer to the matter brought up by counsel, which is, of course, the filing of the late briefs. As this court knows, the United States filed a brief late Saturday. We received it sometime around 6 o'clock on Sunday. And then Mr. Falk, with a remarkable diligence, filed a brief last night. I believe we received it at about 6 o'clock last night.
You may have, if you have that in mind, the opportunity to submit a response and comment.
Thank you, Your Honor. That was my request. Your Honor, to make some of these points, we are faced with an opinion. The opinion contains two rules. We say you must reverse that opinion. That's our position. That's what the police face. That's what we face. That's what law enforcement faces. That's what the courts face. Not what Mr. Falk writes now. On that score alone, these opinions must be reversed. Now, let me go further. The subpoena is not a summary.
He defends the judgments below with respect to the press completely, doesn't he?
No, Your Honor, no.
He doesn't?
Mm-mm.
How is that?
Well, he retreats on several grounds. First, the judgment below contains no distinction between evidence, or may I use the discredited term, mere evidence. Mere evidence.
Whatever you say in California is all right.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mere evidence, then, my authority is Warden V. Hay. And contraband, fruits and instrumentalities. Now we retreat from the rule below and say it shan't apply to instrumentalities, fruits, or contraband. That's one retreat. Second, the clear showing aspect and the important material. That we retreat from. That's no longer required.
That drops out, too.
Your Honor, I do agree with you. It is difficult to discover who's on first in this case. We have now a suggestion that if the warrant itself, should it happen, itself demonstrate that there's no connection and that these are indeed clergymen engaged in preparing sermons for Sunday morning use only, that then and only then does this rule apply.
Yeah, but we have to decide whether a judgment stands up or not.
Precisely, Your Honor.
And he certainly defends the judgment.
Well, Your Honor, you are the best judge of that.
Well, he certainly doesn't suggest that the judgment be reversed.
Not in so many words.
He doesn't, in any kind of words, right? He thinks it should be, the judgment should be affirmed.
Your Honor, I've only 6 minutes. I'll gladly agree with you.
You have only three and a half.
Pardon, Your
three
Honor?
And a half.
Three and a half. Thank you.
Mr. Collins, just one question, if I may. Yes. Do we have any case or controversy before us that involves anybody except a newspaper?
From the beginning, Your Honor, we've had severe doubts whether there is a case of controversy. And the case cited by the United States in their brief of Ashcroft at 431 U.S., we have much difficulty
Well, at the very most, we have a case involving a newspaper. We have nothing else.
At the most, you have a case involving a student newspaper, yes.
And a case involving mere evidence. We don't have a case involving contraband or anything like that.
Absolutely true.
We don't have a damage claim. We don't have an injunction.
We don't have an injunction.
One other question about the attorney's fees. Does their fee award include, there are two opinions on the issue of fees, one on whether they get them, and secondly, how much. Does the fee award include payment for the time spent in getting the fees awarded?
My answer is yes. It includes that plus what was referred to as the contingent nature of the services rendered, for which an extra $10,000 was added on.
And, of course, it probably includes compensation for the argument about all the non-newspaper aspects of the case, too.
Of course, Your Honor. In fact, I think that equity, and not only the Chancellor's foot, would demand that we get attorney's fees for knocking down this third-party rule as stated by the court. Your Honor, I'm told things about California law which frankly appall me. I'm told that it's a summary procedure, I can get a warrant. That is not so. A warrant does not issue to a district attorney under 1539 of the California Penal Code unless there is a pending proceeding with a date set. It is true that the grand jury can get a warrant, but not the district attorney.
You mean a subpoena, don't you?
A subpoena, I beg your pardon. Thank you. A subpoena that cannot be obtained. Now, that is a fact on which I can assure you I am correct. The grand jury does not sit as do the federals, and I notice the United States in their briefs do not concede this point. They bring to your attention the fact it will hurt them. Their grand juries even do not sit but once every 60 days in the Middle West or the Rockies or wherever it was they cited, I can't remember. Ours cover 3.8% of the total cases in our state. Your Honours, this rule was ill-conceived from the beginning. Counsel's frantic efforts to salvage something out of the mess, I say, are ridiculous. It will put a burden upon us. We will have to show all these factors. We will have to go through this measured, contemplative, or one might even say meditative procedure of the law before we can get our hands. This very hospital search, counsel doesn't tell you that the patient said you can have them, but the doctor thought he would assert a privilege.
The time has expired, Mr. Connors.
Thank you for permission to file.
Case is submitted. Thank you, gentlemen.